I'll make some comments while you're setting up. I just want to remind you to indicate who you are speaking on behalf of when you introduce yourself. The podium can go up or down depending on your height preference. You've both been here before, so you do understand the appellate rules. I need to have our marshal call the next case for consideration. Thank you.
Calling A241767, Deanna M. Corton, appellant, versus St. Louis Park Hockey Boosters, also known as St. Louis Park Hockey Association, respondent.
And appellate counsel, when you're ready, go ahead.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Stephen Fiebiger on behalf of the appellant, Deanna Corton. Deanna Corton left her job as a bartender at Bunny's in St. Louis Park for a pull tab sales position based at Bunny's in Northeast Minneapolis, based upon misrepresentations that she would receive permanent and fill-in shifts selling pull tabs at the lucrative Bunny's St. Louis Park location based on her seniority and earn at least what she was earning bartending at Bunny's at St. Louis Park. But she was not given the terms and conditions that she was promised. She complained that the association had violated Minnesota Statute Section 181.64 governing false statements as inducement to entering employment in a letter she hand-delivered to the gambling manager in July of 2018. After her complaint, she was subjected to retaliation in the form of an angry in-person confrontation at her work site by the gambling manager. Her shifts were changed and work hours changed. She was given unfavorable job assignments and ultimately terminated in February of 2019. She sued for violation of the Minnesota Whistleblower Act and Minnesota Statute 181.932, Subdivision 1-1, for the retaliatory treatment, for reporting in good faith a suspected law violation, and obtain a default judgment.
Let's talk about the whistleblower claim. Here's what I struggle with, and help me through this. So she tenders the letter, and that's the basis of your whistleblower claim, but then she stayed working. So that's the gist, as I read it, of the district court's decision. Is that where was the retaliation because she continued to work?
Yes, so the retaliation ramped up after the letter she gave to the gambling manager in July of 2018. Her shift started to decrease in terms of the quality of assignments that she received. She was working primarily at the Bunny's Northeast location.
So are you saying all of this stems from the letter, that this all flows from the letter?
That's right, yes.
Okay.
And so that continued into the fall. There was another meeting in September of 2018 with the gambling manager and assistant manager. They said things would change, but they didn't.
And Mr. Fiebiger, with respect to damages, I mean, would you agree? I think it's a common sense principle that a plaintiff cannot require duplicative damages. You know, if there's two different theories, and if plaintiff has sustained damages of X, plaintiff can't get 2X because there's two theories, right?
Right.
And so, I mean, and so she already had an award of damages on a different theory, correct?
Correct.
So what damages did she sustain directly related to the whistleblower claim that were not previously awarded?
Sure. And just to back up on that a little bit, Your Honor, the original award, the $10,033.44, was for the first 6 months of her employment, January of 2017, out 6 months. That's what the district court awarded for the two common law claims, the promissory estoppel claim and false inducement claim that were part of the complaint. The damages for the Whistleblower Act claim began after the July 18th, 2018 letter. That was
so different time
over
periods.
A year later, right.
Different
set of facts entirely.
Okay. And isn't it true? I mean, the district court reasoned that she had not actually suffered a decline in income, or income had essentially remained the same. Is that where the issue lies?
Well, that's certainly part of the issue, Your Honor. And I think that was the tenor of the district court's order, that, you know, she really didn't lose anything as a result of this letter that she complained about the other statutory violation in January or July of 2018. But the facts show otherwise. The facts show that her income did go down, and she took on another part-time job selling pull tabs for this Minnesota Youth Athletic Initiative to try to make ends meet. Her income was going down because she was getting changed assignments. The managers were assigning newer employees to better shifts.
Okay, but this kind of goes back to what I was trying to ask you. You know, I'm looking at the trial court order, and the judge says she was actually working for the new nonprofit, and by plaintiff's own testimony, the appellant here, the nonprofit charity that ran the pull tab booth at Bunny's changed to the defendant. So that's what I can't understand, how you can capsulize all the flow of the damages into the new entity that she continued to work for.
The damages, Your Honor, are based on the decrease or differential in what she would have been earning had she stayed as a bartender, the $42,104 at Bunny's initially. We're basically asking for the differential in what she actually earned, and we set that out through her W-2 forms, her own testimony. Those are the black and white numbers that show what she earned versus what she was told she earned.
But how can that go? This is a complicating factor with this, I think, is on the claim of, was it promissory estoppel or fraudulent inducement? I thought it was promissory estoppel. Was that
there were both claims?
Okay, whichever one it was to induce her to take the job. And the district court made findings of damages of 6 months' pay, saying that at that point, essentially making a decision that at that point she should have known. So the difference between what she would have earned at Bunny's and what she earned in the new job has already been accounted for, and that's under that theory of recovery. Then you have the Whistleblower Act violation. Why then would you be able to, why then should the measure of those damages be, oh, what she would have earned if she had stayed at Bunny's? Because the whistleblower violation comes well after, right? She leaves the bartending position. So it seems like the whistleblower damages could only be the difference in salary at the point of the violation compared to what she earned from, I guess, a reduction in shifts or getting unfavorable shifts or something. But it seems like instead you're saying, no, let's go back to Bunny's and let's measure that full difference. And that doesn't really seem to track to the violation itself.
Well, the point of using her prior earnings at Bunny's St. Louis Park, the $42,104, as a measure of calculating the wage loss differential is because that's what she continued to lose as she continued to work at Bunny's Northeast selling pull tabs, but she was losing money.
But that's already been
throughout.
Accounted for in the damages for the promissory estoppel, has it not?
Well, it was for 6 months.
Right, which a district court decided that's all she should get. She shouldn't get up to the present time. At the time of trial, the district court reasoned, and I think that's not before us anymore, right, that issue.
For those claims, right.
Right.
This is entirely about the Minnesota Whistleblower
right.
Act claim. But
so
nothing
it seems surprising to revive the theory that she should have gotten the salary that she was earning when she left Bunny's for the whistleblower claim.
Well, I think it's a reasonable point of measuring her damages and lost wages moving forward and lost earning capacity or lost future earnings as well as the lost shift income. She continued to think that the promises that she would receive the fill-in shifts, the part-time shift, the better hours, opportunities to work selling pull tabs at Bunny St. Louis Park would happen while she was continuing to work there. While she continued to work after she gave the letter to the gambling manager in July of 2018, there was no determination that she could only seek, you know, the first 6 months of her work there for damages. The case hadn't been started then. So she did not proceed in her position thinking that, well, she's not going to ever be able to expect to earn what she made at Bunny's St. Louis Park as a bartender because the claim hadn't been decided. Mm-hmm. That's
when did she start working? When did she leave her bartender job and start working?
It was January of 2017.
January 2017. And the letter was July of 2018.
Right.
So I appreciate your argument. Do you give us, if the theory that the damages should be measured not as of Bunny's, but as of what she was earning at the point of that letter and then the adverse actions that followed, do you provide a number, did you provide to the district court, do you provide to us a number that what that differential would be for back pay? The difference between what she was earning, like don't make the bartending the comparator, but instead what she was earning at the point of the whistleblower violation, what the back pay damages would be then for lost shifts and unfavorable shifts and that kind of thing.
Sure, and we, I think the differential that we set out is based on the Bunny St. Louis Park.
Okay.
You know, but that raises a good point, Your Honor, because we didn't have access to any of the other information about what co-employees were earning who were selling pull tabs at Bunny St. Louis Park or Bunny's Northeast, for that matter. We had no comparator evidence in terms of other wages and income that co-employees were earning who were selling pull tabs at either location. So that really put us at a disadvantage in trying to show here's what Ms. Cortan was making after she presented the, you know, the letter that formulated the whistleblower claim versus what other employees doing the same thing were making.
Did you have, well, obviously she would have evidence of what she was earning in June 2018 versus what she earned after that. Is there a decrease in wages after that?
Yes, I think there is. I can't quote the numbers off the top of my head, but there was a decrease such that she went out and got another part-time job selling pull tabs at another establishment.
And if you mitigate your damages by doing that, is the employer still responsible then for the damages that you mitigated by getting another job? Should those damages be awarded under a whistleblower claim?
Yes, I think so, because it's a but for the conduct of the violation of the Whistleblower Act and change in the terms and conditions of the employment that she had to go out and do that.
Can you address your claim for the emotional damages? Your time is running down, and I wanted to hear further argument on that. The district court found that, I'm sorry, I had to cough for no reason. The district court says your emotional damages did not flow naturally from any whistleblower violation.
And, Your Honor, we think the emotional distress damages did flow naturally from the events of July 18th, 2018, when she gave the letter to the gambling manager. I think it's interesting to point out that none of the cases cited by the district court really explain what the term of flow naturally means. In the Camrath case that put that out there for the first time, they pointed to treatment that the plaintiff had received from, I think it was a psychologist or counselor, but each case really needs to be examined individually in terms of how the emotional distress damages flow from the events prompting liability. And here, we can see that happen with Ms. Cortan. She talked about, for example, the confrontation, the angry confrontation by the gambling manager coming to her work site unannounced, getting right into her space. And
well, the court says there's you didn't produce any evidence that she sought any outside care. I mean, that's a part of the court's memorandum finding. So was there any, I mean, can you point us to anything in the record that shows that besides, you know, inability to sleep? I'm not discounting that, but was there any outside help sought for any of the issues that she complained of?
No, there was no other outside care or professional care, but that isn't required for damages under the Minnesota Whistleblower Act. She can provide her own personal testimony that, you know, she had anxiety, stress, crying, loss of sleep. All of those are compensable under the Minnesota Whistleblower Act for emotional distress damages, similar to the Minnesota Human Rights Act that will award those types of damages. And this is a good case where those should be awarded because she did suffer emotional distress. She didn't seek treatment or counseling, but she suffered emotional distress because of the violations of the Minnesota Whistleblower Act, and she should be compensated appropriately.
Thank you.
I see my time's elapsed.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is William Davidson. I represent the respondent, St. Louis Park Hockey Boosters, also known as the St. Louis Park Hockey Association. We are here on this second appeal following a very limited remand following this court's unanimous order opinion a little bit more than a year ago, back in January of 2024. The two issues that were remanded, and I believe the sole issues here on appeal, are whether the district court clearly erred in following this court's remand instruction as to the prejudgment interest issue, and also whether the district court clearly erred or abused its discretion in the remand to make express factual findings and further findings as to whether Ms. Cortan, whether the appellant plaintiff, sustained damages for the defendant's violation of the Minnesota Whistleblower Act. I'll go in reverse order briefly just to touch base on the prejudgment interest. I do not believe there was any error by the district court. The district court followed this court's remand instruction, the remand instruction directed the court administrator to calculate prejudgment interest. The district court directed the court administrator to award prejudgment interest. I think the potential dispute is that no specific number was calculated and that no specific reference to 2024 was referenced. To the extent that's error, it's harmless error because under 549.09, the appellant gets her prejudgment interest from the time of bringing suit to the time of the award at the appropriate statutory rate, depending on whether we're 4% or 5% or above $50,000 at 10%. But she also gets 549.09 subdivision 2 post-award or post-judgment interest calculated in the same amount. So the math isn't going to change. The award will be satisfied depending on whatever the ultimate interest is. And with respect, the district court did not clearly err in following this court's remand instruction on that prejudgment interest directive.
I mean, was there a judgment? Was there any number actually reduced to judgment on the interest?
And entered by the district court? I don't believe so, Your Honor. There was the $10,033.44 awarded on damages in the first go-round and some $800 or so in costs. That was entered, but I have not seen the court administrator enter an actual number.
So what's supposed to happen? I mean, you're arguing it doesn't need to come here for us to do it. Well, how does that number get in there? Who makes it happen then?
Well, typically, the parties would do their math, show each other's number, and satisfied. I can tell you the $10,000 or so dollars is sitting in my firm's trust account, and once this is all resolved, will be paid. And if counsel can't work out the judgment interest, whether pre or post, presumably we'll be back in front of Judge Sullivan. But the statute is clear in terms of 549.09 Subdivision 2, the post-award, post-judgment interest. Interest continues to accrue on any unsatisfied judgment, and it's the same calculation, whether you call it prejudgment interest under Subdivision 1.
Essentially, you're just asking for the court to enter judgment on, assuming it's affirmed, enter judgment on the amount.
Correct.
Amounts that have been set forth by the trial court.
Correct. And so, with respect, again, I believe the district court, Judge Sullivan, properly followed this court's remand instruction as to that. Perhaps the larger issue, and not perhaps, the larger issue is the district court following, or whether the district court properly followed this court's remand instruction to make specific findings as to whether Ms. Cortan sustained damages for the Minnesota Whistleblower Act violation.
I do want to get to that. Let me just dot one I on the
sure.
previous one. Are you arguing, did I understand you correctly, do we need to decide, the first one, first issue about the prejudgment interest, when it should be, when it should go through? The original judgment or the amended, or is there? Are you saying that we don't even need to decide any
I don't
of that
think
because
this,
there's not some, tell
I,
me why.
I apologize, Judge. I don't think you need to parse down whether the award, the first award is when the prejudgment interest should have been calculated up to that point, or the amended judgment and award should calculate us to that point, because it doesn't matter. When you look at Subdivision 1 and Subdivision 2, the same interest rate accrues. And so at the end of the day, when this judgment is satisfied, the same amount will be recovered by the appellant.
Is there any other reason we wouldn't need to reach it? Is it because that the order itself on its face was?
That as well. The district court followed this court's remand instruction and specifically ordered the entry of prejudgment interest and directed the court administrator to do so. Now, there is arguably a question as I read appellant's brief. Judge Sullivan said 2020 and 2021, 4% interest, 2022 and 2023, 5% interest, and didn't say anything about 2024. And the amended judgment and amended award was issued in September of 2024.
So under your, what you're representing is that post-judgment interest would apply between, starting from the original judgment.
Yes.
Okay, even though the, you know, you're the respondent here, et cetera, up until the point of collection on that? Or?
Correct.
Okay.
Apologize for not making that clearer, and hopefully that is now more clear. In terms of the Minnesota Whistleblower Act, the standard of review remains the same as back on the first appeal in terms of the district court's findings and whether the district court, in terms of its findings, as the finder of fact, committed clear error or as to certain things, abused its discretion. We do not believe that the district court was required to award damages. This court remanded for further findings, and Judge Sullivan carefully analyzed this, addressed it. Judge Sullivan was the finder of fact that heard the evidentiary evidence and heard the testimony from the sole witness that testified, Ms. Cortan, reviewed the evidence, explained her rationale and reasoning, noted that the Minnesota Whistleblower Act allows an award, may award appropriate relief, and Judge Sullivan decided to exercise that discretion not to award further relief and explained her rationale. In terms of the specifics of the damages that would naturally flow from this July 2018 letter, Judge Sullivan recognized, well, if appellant is claiming she was terminated 7 months later, I believe February of 2019, because of that letter, and she continued working at the same location, but for a different employer, a different nonprofit that was operating that pull tab operation at that northeast location of Bunny's, Judge Sullivan recognized or believed that the damages were no different and that nothing flowed naturally from that July 18 letter.
So even if she were, so what the reasoning with respect to the termination, right, was a termination, right, by the employer here?
Yes.
Okay. Terminated in February of 2019.
Yes.
And the court says, and we know there's, okay. And the court says, however, by plaintiff's own testimony, I'm on addendum 005, the nonprofit charity that ran the pull tab booth at Bunny's Northeast changed from defendant to the Minneapolis
Hockey Association,
such that no one was no one was any longer working for defendant Bunny's. and she continued to work. So if she's terminated, so if they, the rationale then is that the decision to terminate couldn't have been a whistleblower violation?
No, I think.
Help me with this.
Judge Sullivan struggled perhaps in understanding what appellant's theory was. And so Judge Sullivan, as I read her decision, went down the two potential paths. If termination was the claim, Judge Sullivan concluded that the termination 7 months later from the letter being presented, the Whistleblower Act violation, caused her no damages in terms of lost wages because she continued working, earning the same amount for a different employer at that location. So
she basically mitigated her damages by continuing to work.
That would be one way to characterize it. I don't believe.
And can an employer not be responsible for the damages of terminating an employee if the person?
In general, an employer can be responsible for damages that a plaintiff sustains, but if the plaintiff meets her obligation to mitigate her damages, you don't get to double dip. You don't get, well, I would have had these damages anyways. I know I mitigated. And perhaps Judge Sullivan concluded that there was mitigation that occurred there.
I mean, is there any other reason not to award? If there's...
Sure. Judge Sullivan could have also concluded, I don't find it credible that the damages being claimed, this grand differential theory, going back at that point 3 years to 2016, what she earned as a bartender for a different employer should be the denominator or the comparison basis.
I was thinking more of the termination. Okay. If someone is terminated and liability is established. So
sure, and
the,
I think
you
judge,
could, the district court could decide, yeah, but that damage didn't relate to the liability for the whistleblower.
The district court could make that determination, and recognizing the termination here was a result of a change in operators for this particular location. And so Judge Sullivan could have assessed the credibility that this termination was due to a letter being given 7 months earlier with a jaundiced eye. Juries, fact finders do that all the time, where they may hear evidence that unrebutted or otherwise and determine, you know, it doesn't pass the smell test or it doesn't pass my smell test. It doesn't seem to be appropriate. I suspect this court sees, I certainly see it, jury verdicts that decline to award future medical expenses or future pain and suffering. Even though there's been evidence presented of future care, they reject the expert testimony. It occurs, and respectfully, that's not clear error by the finder of fact, in this case, Judge Sullivan. Now, the second path, as I understood Judge Sullivan regarding the and the findings she made regarding the Minnesota Whistleblower Act, is whatever earnings were lost at the time of that July 2018 letter until the termination in February of 2019. Judge Sullivan heard that evidence that plaintiff presented and concluded that there was no change in her conditions, that her shifts remained the same by her own testimony in the complaint. That was the basis of her larger claim. It's not what I expected back in 2016 when I started here, but Judge Sullivan looked at that following this court's remand instruction, July 2018, forward and concluded there was no additional lost earnings or that the appropriate relief for such claimed lost earnings was not appropriate in this case under the circumstances of this case. Separately, Judge Sullivan then also addressed the emotional distress damages being claimed, explained in fairly good detail, I believe, her rationale and her reasoning. And respectfully, I don't believe that appellant has established that that was clear error in that analysis or in the explanation as to why Judge Sullivan concluded no emotional distress damages flowed from, naturally or otherwise, from the Minnesota Whistleblower Act claim.
Can you help me a little bit with the second one, which is, as I understood the argument is, okay, leave aside the termination. After I gave the letter complaining of a violation, my income was reduced because I got worse assignments. And the district court wrote, at the point you're at, if the retaliation occurred in 2018 when plaintiff sent the letter, I mean, I think that wouldn't be when retaliation occurred necessarily. I mean, it could occur any time after that. But
sure.
There's no basis for awarding compensatory damages for lost earnings because according to plaintiff's own allegations, her schedule and shifts did not change after the meeting where she gave Nichols the letter and then cites a complaint. What did complaint paragraph 29 say? I mean, I'm trying to square what I'm hearing about, my income, suggestions maybe that income continued to go down in bad shifts, which if they were tied to evidence could be a basis for damages, I would think, for retaliation.
Well, looking quickly, I believe it's at addendum 25 carrying over to 26, the complaint in paragraph 29 talks about a supposed change in the schedule and the shifts thereafter. But I believe Judge Sullivan in the earlier section that Your Honor read, I believe addendum 16 or 17, concluded that there was no change in shifts and that she made the same July 18, 2018 for those next 7 months. And to the extent that appellant or plaintiff argues no, but there was a change in shift, that's a disputed issue of fact that was tried and assessed and evaluated by the finder of fact. Okay. And Judge Sullivan concluded, whether assessing no credibility for that conclusion or those assertions or just rejecting them, that's something that I believe this court should respect. I apologize for cutting you off.
No, I was going to cut you off, so I'm sorry.
Oh, that's fine.
So complaint paragraph 29 doesn't really square with what the district court wrote here. Is that fair to say?
Well, it sets forth in paragraph 29 the allegations that what appellant's characterization or plaintiff's characterization of what occurred. Uh-huh. I do think it squares in. It says the third line, there had been no changes. And there had been, your schedule is your schedule, and she worked. Now, whether that's a disputed issue of fact or otherwise, mm-hmm. ultimately, Judge Sullivan rejected the claim that damages naturally flows or lost earning damages flowed from that. I see my time is up. I'm happy to address any more questions, but we would respectfully request that this court affirm both remand issues, the Minnesota Whistleblower Act further findings as not clearly erroneous, and that there's no error, certainly not anything beyond harmless error as to the prejudgment interest.
Thank you, Mr. Davidson. And Mr. Pieberger, you have the last word.
Just following up on the point about the complaint, paragraphs 29, it's our view that the district court took that language out of context in saying that Ms. Cortan had said she didn't have any changes since before the whistleblower violation. That's really not what the complaint says. In part, in paragraph 29, it reads, it says, on September 20, 2018, plaintiff met with Nichols and Nash because there had been no changes in the working conditions and scheduling of shifts. Previously, since the June schedule, there was a three-week rotation on weekends. There had been no changes. That's the context of that language. There were no changes with respect to the three-week rotations on weekends. Paragraph 30 of the complaint clears this up, and we pointed that out in our brief. Starts, although it was clearly understood at the September meeting that the existing schedule would remain as a schedule going forward, Nash changed the schedule again in October 2018 in an attempt to schedule plaintiff for shifts that she knew plaintiff was unable to work. Nash also informed plaintiff via text that if she could not work the scheduled shifts, that plaintiff would need to find someone to work them. These were shifts that no one wanted to work because the income potential was lowest. This is how they retaliated against her after the letter was presented to the gambling manager.
And what record in the evidence, or what evidence in the record tells us what the difference is between shifts in June of 2018 and those after, and what result it had for her financially, such that it would justify an award of damages for that difference between what was happening in June 2018 and thereafter?
Sure. We have Ms. Cortan's testimony in the evidentiary hearing, essentially mirroring what I just read from her complaint, that she was assigned shifts that were unfavorable, that would earn less tips at the Bunny's Northeast, that wasn't as profitable and lucrative as the Bunny's St. Louis Park location. She was assigned shifts. She didn't want or couldn't work, and the employer knew she couldn't work, so she would have to find somebody to take her shift. So she would lose that shift. Unfortunately, we didn't get any discovery with any of the records of shifts that she was scheduled or were rescheduled with somebody else taking her place. Mm-hmm. And so that's a real prejudicial impact that should not be weighed against Ms. Cortan on the default judgment. But that's essentially what is happening when we don't have access to any of the evidence because it was never produced.
But you do have access to what she earned and right. What shift she worked. So that's what I'm trying to figure out. What amount should the district court, in your view, have awarded, and what does the evidence show for the unfavorable shifts between July of 2018 and her termination in February of 2019?
We think they should award the wage differential amount that we've cited. It shows that she
comparing had her income, it to Bunny's.
Her income decreased from 2018 okay. until she left, until she was fired. That would be the position. Just in terms of this, the prejudgment interest issue, we think that it's up to the district court to calculate it. We need a number in the judgment or amended judgment. That wasn't done, or direct the district court administrator to calculate it.
But you don't need something from this court to direct the district court to do that. That's a mechanical function of court administration, isn't it?
Well, it should be,
yeah.
And we expected that it would be done, but it wasn't. And at some point, there needs to be a number with the
interest. Right, but you
interest.
Need to request the district court to reduce the judgment and add the interest. The court administration does that.
I hope so. It wasn't done here.
In my experience as a trial court judge, you'd have a decision, and eventually the party that's the recipient of whatever the damages are would then ask the court to issue a judgment as far as the interest is concerned. Do you think this court needs to say something in an opinion on that?
Well, I think based on what happened here, it would be helpful to say this needs to be calculated and put into the judgment.
The court to reduce the award to a judgment which would compute the interest?
Not beyond
right, so that hasn't
what
been
happened.
Exhausted.
All right. We would ask that the decision be reversed as requested.
Thank you.
Thank you
to both attorneys. The arguments are always helpful to our decision making. The matter is under advisement, and a decision will be issued in the 90-day statutory time frame.